Sam got a bet.
Oh, you know.
And God definitely.
In September, Louisville officials agreed to pay $12 million to settle a wrongful death lawsuit brought by Ms. Taylor's mother and to institute reforms aimed at preventing future deaths by officers. In Los Angeles, I'm Tunde Sizwe Chimaringa. You've been listening to Say Her Name, Black Women, Police Violence, and Abolition on Making Contact. Special thanks to the Left Tilt Fund for their support. For other shows and more information about this episode, visit radioproject.org. This show was edited and co-produced by Anita Johnson. The executive director of Making Contact is Sanya Green. Lisa Rudman is director of production initiatives and distribution. Making Contact producers are Monica Lopez, Anita Johnson, and Salima Hamarani. Web updates, Sabine Blazin. Production assistant, Emily Rose Thorne. And I'm Tunde Sizwe Chimaringa. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
KBOO Portland.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we are very fortunate to have the members of the December 1st Writers Group. They've been on Transpositive before. They're a group of poets that got together and have been performing in the Portland area for a number of years now, commemorating December 1st, which is World AIDS Day, and also happens to fall on this evening. So we're gonna be sharing some of their new and old works. And I'd like to introduce all of them to you. We have David Rutheiser, Pat Vivian, Sylvia Zingazer, and Marla Allen. Welcome everyone to Transpositive. How are y'all doing?
Good.
Good.
Well,
yeah.
Great. So David, could we start, David, could you just tell us for just a minute or two about the, you know, kind of this abbreviated history of the December 1st writers?
Well, I can certainly tell my side of it. I mean, I'm sure each of these people would have their own story about how it came to be for them. For me, you know, it was just that in 2013, Sylvia, who I've known since 1988, asked me, what I was going to be doing for December 1st for World AIDS Day. And she wanted to do something to commemorate her, the life and the death of her son, Aaron Arney, who she wrote a book of poems about. And I didn't have any plans at that time. And Sylvia had managed to keep in touch with Marla. She can tell you more about that whole part of the story. And meanwhile, I had known Pat because of the Portland poetry community. When I started hanging out in the Portland poetry communities in the late 1980s, she was already writing and reading poems she had written about how AIDS had impacted her life personally. So we got together and we've been doing it ever since. You know, whatever money we collect, we donate to an AIDS organization. And that's our mission, is to, spread the word about AIDS and HIV and how it's impacted our lives.
Thank you. So I think we're going to jump right into hearing some poetry and some new or old works from y'all. And as we're going through the interview tonight, we will stop and have some conversations too, but I want to give as much time as possible to the poets. So I think you are actually first up, David. So if you'd like to start and sure. introduce yourself and let us know what works you're reading.
So I'm David Rutheiser. I'll be reading five short pieces this evening. This first one is called In the West, March 1987. I had never seen red earth with deep green pines etched in snow, over the pass and then down into Laramie. Suddenly, I was in the West, driving all the way from Iowa, where I'd been kicked out of college, to Oregon, where my mom had moved in the meantime, abandoning me. From Chicago, land of straight streets and exact diagonals into the flat horizon, a city of blocks into suburbs. I'd visited California and Oregon via plane. On the way to Oregon with my mom, we'd descended into Salt Lake City, marveling at multi-layered cliffs. But I had never really driven into the mountains. I was 18 and didn't think about politics. The ranches on either side with snow-capped mountains towering above them with people in cowboy hats and jeans felt exciting and patriotic. I listened to the only radio stations whose signal came in, country. Someone named Earl Thomas Conley lamenting, "Love don't care whose heart it breaks." I listened and sang along. My mom hadn't believed me when I told her. And Ichiro, my foreign exchange roommate from Tokyo, had asked, "Do you know what people are saying about you?" As I made my way west, I surely drove past the exact spot where, 13 years later, a young man the age I was now would hang beaten, bloodied, and burned from a fence post outside one of those ranches beneath those same imposing mountains for being gay like me.
Thank you.
What Corky said. At the gay men's breakfast group, as I turn my back, I overhear Corky say how he can't stand some guy who tried to Jew him down. I retain an image of Corky's hollow mouth, his few jagged brown teeth, his face a permanent snarl, his fingernails that probably dug all day in the garden. And I remember my grandmother's hand, one of her fingernails missing, a slight hollow where it had been, and how my mother told me grandma had come through Ellis Island with an infection, how they'd insisted it be removed, or else they'd send her back to the pogroms. And I think of my grandmother now, and of my grandfather, having never asked for anything for less than its worth, as I hear them and their whole line of laborers and ranchers and farmers diminished to a verb. My dad's psychologist friend, Dennis. Your father loves you, but you're still a little boy. I'm here to fix you. Dennis hides behind his brown beard, tapping his hand, telling me when he catches me talking honestly to my father that it's rude to talk about personal things in his house. My father says nothing. Dennis is a psychologist friend of my father's. We're trapped in his family home in upstate New York during an April blizzard. Dennis corners me and asks me if I like girls. I am 13. My father sits there and says nothing. I say I like some of them. Dennis asks me if I have men in my life to look up to. My father asks, brother Irenaeus, referring to a teacher at the private school I'd moved 1,000 miles away from almost a year ago when my mother divorced him. Therefore, I think, my father is being idiotic and doesn't even make sense. Dennis then points out my crossed legs and tells me, if I keep sitting like this, homosexual men will approach me. He tells me not to worry, though, that there's a solution. To watch men on TV, like Tom Selleck, and imitate them. Years from now, people will hear this story and laugh. But Dennis is serious. My dad is sitting there, and none of us are laughing. I want to ask Dennis if there shouldn't be anything personal in this house. How is this not personal? And if this is what Dennis also teaches his 5 sons, one severely asthmatic, while his wife chain smokes in the baby's room. I want to ask my father what he sees in Dennis. I hear that Dennis is the one who introduced himself to my father in a room full of people. When I get back to Chicago after the snow melts, I will tell my mother, and my mother will tell her lifetime friend, Marcia, always like an aunt to me. And Marcia will call my father and yell at him that she'll never speak to him again as long as she lives, and then keep that promise a few years later by dropping dead of a heart attack, a luxury I seem not to have whenever he descends like a cloud on the condo my mother and I live in, his prisoners, and barks at me for turning off the radio she always left on. When did I start making the rules around here? And I'm 13 all over again, in that damn house, in the damn blizzard, the ice cracking in Dennis's malt glass as my father lets the interrogation continue. My mother will send me to see a counselor at Jewish Family and Child Services in Chicago, who I will develop a crush on. My father will continue to insist, Dennis was just trying to help you. I still cringe whenever I hear anyone say they're just trying to help. Waiting. The PCC parking lot, though enlarged, is still inadequate for the number of people, and I'm blocked in by the line of cars. I spend the elongated minutes noticing plants in their sunken beds, the angles of brick, a woman's dark hair contoured by afternoon light, a stray dry leaf, a student walking past. When my mother and I were trapped in the condo for a week during the big ice storm, I imagined 2 spiders, and how, when one spider finds the other's corner, one will end up eaten, with only its spindly legs left behind, one leg still pulsing with the same energy it had used in life. And how everything that week felt swollen and claustrophobic. My mom's dresser drawers seemed to be watching me, and the brown splotches expanded on the skins of the bananas in the basket on the kitchen counter, and my grandparents' old clock that my mom could never get rid of still didn't work, sitting on my grandparents' old piano that still no longer played, below a painting of old European houses along a river with some old cathedral looming in the background. The place seemed to sink into itself. On the 4th day, I couldn't stand it anymore, and I yelled at my mother. Now, she isn't here at all. She's just gone, and the radio blares another mass shooting, and now I can finally pull out of my parking place, and I obsess again over my always low bank account, again a prisoner to life's arithmetic. All the way to the pizza joint where I settle for the one trip salad bar, and the balloon man twists happiness into the 2 brothers who were fighting over the video games when I came in. And the 1980s music takes me back to high school and being a passenger of my parents when a song was all it took to be free. This is my last piece for this evening. Mariposa's Flight. She confesses it isn't her real name. Butterfly, in Spanish. Reads her poem in Spanish first, then English, at the open mic at Teatro Milagro, the words flying out of her. She's a student at the Catholic high school up the street, trying the name on for the stage. When her teacher, a young woman, mentions after the reading that they too have connections in Costa Rica, where I'm planning to teach English, and I ask them if they know some of the people from the exchange group I've been attending, and the teacher says she's not allowed to promote outside organizations. I'm confused. I was just wondering, I say, if maybe she's familiar with them or met them in her spare time. The teacher squares her shoulders and steps back. As a teacher, I have free time, she says. That's cute. No, really, that's quaint. I still remember Joshua from years ago writhing under me, his arms twisted behind his striped shirt, his cheek ground into the classroom's rough carpet where I, the aide, had been instructed to sit on him for a seeming eternity till the teacher got back. And my mother taught too, for 40 years without a thyroid, breaking up knife fights, reporting a bomb in the boys' bathroom, mentoring the first boy to be shot to death in gang violence in Portland. And now I'm the one who doesn't understand what it means to be an educator in America. And meanwhile, no matter how teachers may glare at each other, in spite of who's pitted against whom, Mariposa's ready. She's taking flight. She's unfolding her wings in two languages so far. She's soaring on the sound of words. She's spreading her sun-filled colors. She's abandoning her chrysalis. And I know now why I came here, to thank her.
Thank you, David. That was very wonderful. I really enjoyed all of those. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. We are we're talking to members of the December 1st Writers. Today is World AIDS Day, and so we're doing poetry from this collective that formed in response to a common thread among them, and also to raise funds for World AIDS Day. Our next reader is Marla Allen, who the last time I saw Marlon was actually right before the pandemic. So that's how long it's been. Anyways, welcome, Marla. If you'd like to share a little bit about yourself and your poetry, that would be great.
Sure. So I've lived in San Francisco since 1986, and I was diagnosed with HIV in 1988. And I'm a writer. I've just been writing, and that's what I do now. So that's my life. And I live here in San Francisco with my two kitties, and that's what I do. I love San Francisco. So, sure. Okay. So when I was diagnosed with HIV in 1988, I was an atheist. I had come to terms pretty quickly with dying, but I wanted to know where I was going, which is a pretty spiritual question. So since 1988, I have immersed myself in all things afterlife, and my soon-to-be published book called Sally in the Afterlife is a result of my research. The first half of the book is about Sally's life and death, and the second half is about her experience in her afterlife. This is a light, non-religious read with no particular agenda other than a fun escape. If you don't believe in an afterlife, then my book might be a fun fantasy-type read for you. If you do believe in an afterlife, this book may or may not validate some of your beliefs. I will now read a few excerpts from Sally's younger years so you can get to know her a little bit. My name is Sally. This is the story of my life and what happened to me afterward. Most of it's true, but you decide for yourself. Sally's not my real name or even a nickname. I changed it to Sally when I was 3 years old, long before it was acceptable, cool even, to change your name on a whim. To my parents, it was adorable, a phase I would outgrow. Never would they have gone along had they not believed someday I would learn to love the graceful, melodic, significant Hebrew name they had carefully chosen, the name on my birth certificate. I never did. So everyone knew me as Sally, except my family, who called me baby until they thought I wasn't one anymore. But to my dad, I remained forever baby. 1945. My earliest memory is the wretched summer heat in Bensonhurst, keeping me awake at night. I was about 2 years old, the youngest insomniac in the family. Late at night, while everyone slept, my small body drenched with sweat, I slipped out of the new tiny bed that had just replaced my old familiar crib. Guided by the nightlight strategically placed in my bedroom and another in the long hallway, I went in search of the only cool place in the house, the immaculate floor of our large bathroom, a parquet made of small black and white tile in the classic deco style pattern so popular in the 1920s when my parents bought the house. On that clean, cool floor I lay, without a blanket and pillowless, until I drifted off to sleep. Still curled up and dreaming in that small room, I slumbered through the early morning sounds of my family starting their day. On his way to the toilet, one of my brothers tripped over me. "Baby, what are you doing in here?" he shouted in his early morning bark as he hopped around the bathroom from one foot to the other. Half asleep and confused, I let out the tiniest whimper. "Move," he shouted. I tried to be a big girl, but it was just too much. I cried out as I sat on the floor, hot tears shooting from my eyes, and I held up my arms so he would pick me up. When he didn't, I cried even louder. I thought he loved me. "Ma," my brother shouted down the hallway, "baby slept in the bathroom again. Come get her, hurry up, I've got to pee, Ma." 1954. Ever since I can remember, Ma has forced me to eat, even though I've always been chubby. "Finish your dinner, Sally," Ma said. "I can't, Ma, you serve appetizers." I had just learned that word in my home economics class. "What's this, appetizers?" "After the matzo ball soup and gefilte fish, I'm too full to eat dinner. It's too much, Ma." "Hush now. If I ate everything Ma wanted me to, I'd be huge, and that would be the worst thing in the world, and Ma knew that. So when no one was looking, I hid most of my dinner in my napkin and later fed it to our dog, Rufus." "Why can't you eat like your brothers?" Ma asked. "Because they're boys, Ma, and they're bigger than me. They're bigger than you because they eat all their food." Ma didn't care if I was fat, and she didn't care about me. But my pop, he adored me. He spoke with an accent too, but he was much more loving than Ma and the only pure joy in my life. With him around, my childhood was somewhat manageable. Pop and I would sneak off many afternoons for father-daughter adventures while Ma was working, bent over her sewing machine. "Where do you want to go today, baby?" Pop asked as we sat in our car inside the dark garage attached to the side of our house, the faint smell of gasoline permeating the small space. I seriously considered Pop's question as I twirled my long, thick, curly hair around my index finger. On one hand, it was a beautiful day. It was sunny, where we would be able to see the entire city of Los Angeles from Griffith Park Observatory. On the other hand, these outings with Pop were the only time I was allowed to squeeze into my diet anything non-kosher, like hot dogs, and Pink's was a very popular destination for us. I was torn, but only for a minute. "Pink's," I shouted. Pop laughed. "Again? We went there last time." "Please, Pop," I whined. "I want a hot dog." "Okay, baby, but if your mother finds out, she'll bury us both in the backyard to make us kosher again. Just our heads will stick out of the ground." Pop winked and I giggled. "Are you sure you can keep the secret? I promise I can keep the secret. Pinks, please, Pop. We had lots of secrets, Pop and I. I loved it when he sang to me the sunshine song. He serenaded me, looking deep into my eyes, his hand over his heart, head tilted, and I'd smile. And sometimes when he finished singing, he'd tickle me, and that always made me giggle. During those moments with Pop, I felt like the most special, most loved little girl, just like a real princess. My brothers were princes to Ma, simply because they were boys. She did everything for them. When she thought I was old enough, she forced me to be their servant, like her, and cater to their every whim. And not all of them were nice about it either. They took advantage of me, in particular, my brother, Boy. 1961. It was a warm night for the middle of winter, even for Los Angeles. I parked my car in front of Mary's house. We were going out to raise hell in celebration of my 18th birthday, my official entry to adulthood. That's weird. Her house was dark. I approached anyway and knocked on her front door. Mary, I shouted, no answer. I banged on the door and yelled louder. Mary! Mary flung open the front door and my hand shot up to protect my eyes as I was blinded by the intensity of the sudden bright light coming from Mary's living room. Mary, I shouted, shocked, but I was cut off by much louder shouting coming from behind Mary. Surprise! Happy birthday, Sally! Shouted every person I've ever known and a few I didn't from Mary's living room, all throwing confetti in my direction and holding up glasses of champagne. What the? Mary pulled me inside and hugged me. Happy birthday. I can't believe this, Mary. I had no idea. I know, she said and giggled. With lots of champagne and hors d'oeuvres, we danced for hours. Later that night, I took a break from the dancing and went into the kitchen to open another bottle of champagne. And that's when he sauntered through the kitchen door with Tom, a friend from school, and some latecomers I didn't know, a rowdy bunch. Our eyes locked, but I still managed to place that unopened champagne bottle on the counter without dropping it. Tom stepped between us and hugged me. Embarrassed and relieved, I returned Tom's hug. I stood on my tiptoes and whispered into his ear, "Who's the hunk?" "Your birthday present," Tom replied and released me from our embrace. "Thank you," I mouthed. Tom helped himself to one of the glasses of champagne on the counter. "Grab a glass, boys." "Happy birthday, Sally," they toasted me before they joined the other guests in the living room, except him. "Happy birthday, Sally," he whispered. God, he was so handsome. "Thanks. What's your name?" "Ferdinando." "Mm-mm, that's too long." He laughed, a deep, slow, sexy laugh, a knee-buckling laugh. I never noticed I had become the worst guest of honor ever. Well-meaning guests continually interrupted our conversation with happy birthday wishes, but I was already having a happy birthday. "Are you guys going to join the party?" Mary asked us around 11. "No," we said in unison, and then laughed like it was the funniest thing ever said. "Thanks for stopping by," I said. "You too. Happy birthday, Sal," Mary said, giggling as she walked away. Ferdy looked like a movie star. He was sweet and fun and charming and intelligent and kind and funny. Ferdy was a man, not like the boys I'd been dating in high school. We sat in Mary's kitchen for the rest of the evening. An opened bottle of champagne sat between us, our bottle of champagne. We talked long after everyone had gone home. "I have four brothers and my mother is horrible. I can't wait to have a family of my own," I said. "What about you?" "I have one sister and my mother adores me. She's the best and does everything for me." "You're so lucky." "Yeah, she would be happy if I lived at home with her forever, but I want to have a family of my own too." He winked at me and I'm pretty sure I blushed. He leaned in and kissed me lightly. After that, we spoke about our future. "I want a big family, Sally. How about you?" "I think two kids would be good. Maybe a boy and a girl. That would be nice." We spoke for hours about where we wanted to live and what our house would look like. "Ferdy, is it my imagination or is it getting light outside?" Ferdy laughed. "The sun is coming up, Sally. Are you hungry?" "Starving. Come on, let's go to International House of Pancakes." After my birthday party, we were inseparable. I was so happy when we were together and hadn't felt this special since Pop. Pop would have loved him. If you'd like to read more about Sally, you can sign up for Sally in the Afterlife News by visiting my website, MarlaAllenAuthor.com, and enter your email address on the homepage. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Marla Allen. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Emma, and tonight we're talking with members of the December 1st Writers. Today is World AIDS Day, and in honor of World AIDS Day, we are having the December 1st Writers back to share some new or already produced works and talk about their group, which is very unique and has a really great story. Our next reader is Pat Vivian. Pat, welcome.
Hi, I'm Pat Vivian. I'm a professional writer and editor and published poet. And in the late 1980s and early 1990s, I took care of three close friends who died of AIDS, with other people, of course. No one could do that alone. And we may be calling COVID the novel coronavirus, but for those of us who remember the AIDS crisis all too vividly, community spread of a deadly disease while a Republican administration looks the other way is nothing new. We've been here before. We've seen what happens when healthcare for profit gobbles dollars and public health efforts go begging. It's said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over again and expecting different results. Big surprise. Some 40 years later, the results are the same. People die. They die by the thousands. We've gone from the Ronald to the Donald. The first poem I'm going to read tonight, well, actually the first two poems, were written in honor of my dear friend Tom, who died of AIDS in 1988. I dedicate this first poem to Ronald Reagan, and it seems especially timely. It's called Tunnel Vision. This is war. 25,000 were dead, mostly young men, before you deign to utter the A word. I want you to know I'm losing a friend. By sluggish degrees, the virus is invading his brain. The stellar glow that shined out of him that no one could possibly explain is contracting, growing more dense by the hour. He's becoming a white dwarf of a man. We talk long distance. He's always home. How are you, Tom? I ask, and he says, I love you, in answer to my question. We talk about the weather. A chilling fog grips the bay. We talk about his mother. He says there are things they can't talk about anymore. Like what, I ask? The Vietnam War. There are black holes in our conversations. We say the same things again and again. Old jokes like rituals, our personal one-liners. I often repeat myself. I almost always never contradict myself. Do you have trouble making decisions? Well, yes and no. This is war. But there's a lighthouse beam that pierces the fog in Tom's brain, and we invoke it each time we talk on the phone. I say it to him. He says it again. It's the only defense he has. I love you. And in a similar vein, this poem is called Looking for the Enemy. This virus, smaller than a fly's egg, that kills so ruthlessly, cell by cell. Life imitating life, until the poor, fooled body no longer knows itself. While we could blow up the whole world a gazillion times over, stand by the helplessly, looking for the enemy in us versus them. This virus, smaller than anything we know except the atom, the bits and chips of the heat-seeking device, the missile aimed at ground zero. Let it scorch to dust in a man-made desert, melt down when the ozone layer's gone. Tom can be cold, cruel even, but he's human. His mood mutating as I hold him, flesh of his cheek pressed warm against mine. We've lain in the sun on his brick patio, a source of magic and secrecy. Wooden staircases entwined with bonsai and bamboo, giant Dieffenbachia, juniper, three narrow cats. A quail in a cage flutters like a heart on the garbage cans in the heart of the Castro. I tell Tom his tan looks good on him. He's having pain somewhere today. Sometimes the doctor doesn't know what it is. And suddenly he shrugs me off as if I were complicit. I want to have the best looking corpse in San Francisco. I recoil at first from that lead-fisted humor, but when I look in his living face, I see vast sums have been spent on terror, denial, and despair. And way down in there, a tiny bubble swells, renegade until it fills the room. It too is larger than we are, and I'm taken in. I laugh with him. With all that's staring us in the face these days, on the cusp of election results that'll have life and death consequences, I'd like to depart from AIDS and read a couple poems based on real acts of random kindness and senseless beauty. These are events that actually happened and that restored my faith in human nature, at least momentarily. This poem describes an incident on a TriMet number 12 bus around the time Barack Obama became president, leading the blind. The slender woman on the number 12 bus missed her crosstown connection and is lost. Whitened knuckles of a solitary hand clutching a white cane, the other resting on the fur of the panting canine who is also lost. She leans forward into an uncertain future while the driver explores route options and makes calls to help reconnect her. This lopsided three-way intersection is a six-pointed star, splintered off at such odd angles it would be easy to get lost on the corner of Northeast 57, Sandy, and Alameda. Our bus slides to a halt, doors open while the driver exits, offers his arm, and escorts the woman and her guide dog across the street. He waits politely while they board the number 71. All this, of course, takes a few minutes and throws our bus off schedule, leaving everyone else behind, bound to their own connections. But suddenly, now, is something we have plenty of. Here is what you need. Time louvers its doors open wide and settles with its old friend being over the whole bus. We are so ready for this. We are waiting for the light to turn green. We are waiting for more drivers like this. We are ready as he steps back up to his seat to greet him with a groundswell of clapping that rises out of us all like a hungry wave, spontaneous combustion as the bus lurches into motion. The world needs more bus drivers like him. And this next poem is also based on an actual experience. It's a prose poem, Angel of Mercy. No matter how well he knows himself, every morning he wakes in the shape-shifting evolutionary conversation between self and others. He cannot foresee what will happen that day or how it will define him. With a fat nest of snaky dreads framing his face like an aura, baggy pants belted low on angular torso, will he stray into the crosshairs of some cop with a twitchy trigger finger? Or will he be an angel of mercy to someone? Not in a make-believe afterlife sense, but right here and now, today. It's a crisp fall afternoon, all golden light saturated with copper and madder overtones. Lucy and Celia are out for a walk, yakking happily, good friends riding an easy slipstream of conversation, so carried away they've lost track of themselves as bodies moving through space. When Celia catches one sandal in a sidewalk crack, splat, she's down, staring wordlessly at concrete that is way closer to her face than it should be. After a stunned moment, the first impulse is to get up, set things right, go back to normal. But when Celia reaches for a hand to help haul herself off the ground, Lucy blanches and backs away. I can't take your weight. I have a metal plate in my spine. So Celia sits cross-legged on the sidewalk in the glorious sun, looking at her useless hands as if they don't belong to her. Two injured birds dangling at the ends of her arms. That's when the rattling car swerves to the curb. Rap music thumping like a big, big heart. The door flies open and the young guy with dreads leaps out. Are you okay? I don't know. Before Celia can say anything more, he's rock solid behind her, hands locked under her arms, hoisting her to her feet. And the moment slows down as if she could just keep rising this way forever. It's as effortless as being in an elevator, but so much more human. I think I'll end there. Thank you. Thank you, Emma, for having us.
Oh, thank you, Pat. Yeah, that intersection, that's where they tore down that George Washington statue. Now there's just a stump there. Yeah. That'd be a good poem.
It would.
Thank you so much. Our next writer is Sylvia Zingisser. Sylvia, I think you are sort of, in many ways, your son was kind of the thread that tied this whole group together, and hopefully we'll talk about him a little bit.
My son, Aaron Arney, he passed away in 1992, and he was diagnosed, I think it was 1986. And I met Marla in, I think, 1991, 92. And Marla and I have stayed in contact ever since. She was in his support group. And she is the only one from that support group that is alive today. And she has lived with AIDS very successfully. She has a lot of stories to tell about her journey. And she's like a daughter to me. So anyway, that's our connection. And David, I know through folk dancing, through Israeli and Balkan dancing. and the fact that he was a poet, and I had started writing to kind of remember my conversations with my son. I'm going to read two poems today. One of them is that I wrote in 1990, in the 1990s. It's called Fearful Hierarchies, and it's a political poem. It's kind of connected to what has happened with the replacement of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So I will begin. Fearful Hierarchies. When I came back to Portland after my son had died, the Oregon Citizens Alliance was in full tilt with their campaign against gays and lesbians. My anger burned as they vomited like volcanoes from the Ring of Fire. Look at all the trash in the libraries. Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, Emily Dickinson's poems, Gertrude Stein's autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, Tennessee Williams' streetcar named Desire, and you don't want one for a neighbor. It might rub off on you. The OCA tried to convince everyone, even Blacks and Jews, they tried to enlist, saying the Bible says, these pillowed, cased knights hate anyone different. I wanted to shake the lawn maybombs and say, wake up, foolish ones, look around, check the facts. Talk with gay and lesbian and bisexual people. You too are sexual with a history. You must have forgotten how it was when you were 16, driven by the testosterone lying thick in your veins. The fear-driven ballot measure cut deep into my core with its family values, which meant, off with your heads, you heathen ones, let's burn you at the stake. My second poem is recent. On replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg, my RBG, the originalist. This is how the Republican Senate honors RBG. Her years of protecting civil rights, a woman's right to choose how to take care of her body, protecting parents' rights so fathers have the same rights as women do to stay home to take care of their children, so LGBTQ plus people could marry the person they love, have children, not have their written works banned from schools and libraries. President Trump appointed Amy Coney Barrett as Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg replacement to the Supreme Court. The Republican Senate rushed through the vote of Amy Coney Barrett, a constitutional originalist, with only 9 days left before the presidential election. This appointment took us back nearly 200 plus years, back to a time of 13 states forming the Constitution of the United States, in a time of slavery of Black people bought and brought to America to be sold as manpower, as along with horsepower, oxen power, to build wealth for landowners cultivating crops of tobacco and cotton. A time when slaves were considered two-thirds of a human being and women could not vote. A time when men ruled the household with an iron fist and women bore children whether they wanted them or not. Many women lost their lives during childbirth because the original Bible said she had to. The originalist Supreme Court Justice replaced my RBG, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. My blood boils at the thought of stepping back in time to an originalist idea based on a Bible that does not keep up with aging of the world or the people in it. A time when the Constitution was built by our founding fathers who understood they needed wiggle room for growth, for innovation, in an industrial society they had already participated in the advent of basic manufacturing, building ships to sail the seas, to continue trading with other peoples, other countries. As soon as the Constitution was written, amendments began to be written because changes required it. As Senator Angus King, an independent from Maine, pointed out, we didn't have airplanes 200 years ago. Now we do. This is why Amy Coney Barrett should not have been confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. Her originalist belief is a belief from the Bible. It does not represent the changes of time. nor the different beliefs of people who make up American culture. It's archaic. It's one-sided. This has been quite a roller coaster for, I think, for all of us, along with COVID. COVID reminds me of our time when AIDS, we didn't know what AIDS was. We didn't have a vaccine for it. And I have to agree with what Pat said. She said it so beautifully that we've changed a Ronald for a Donald. That's great, Pat. The name of the poetry book is Scared of That, Living While Dying of AIDS. And there's a lot more that I could write about my son, Aaron. As I go through things, now that I'm downsizing, which I've been trying to do for several years now, things that I run into, I can think of, this is how I could remember this, and I could remember this piece that I have in my hand that reminds me of him, that I could write a piece of poetry about that, and that is one way for me to remember and honor my son's life.
If I could, I'd like to open up our conversation. Sure. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to just completely cut you off, Sylvan. I'd like you to continue, but I did want to just let everyone know that we are on the tail end of our interview. We've been talking tonight and listening to new works and old works too by the December 1st Writers, a group that gets together to commemorate World AIDS Day and to raise funds for World AIDS Day, and people who have all been affected in one way or another by the loss or a connection with someone who has had HIV.
I'd like to mention that we do have a website. It's December1stwriters.com. I can't remember if we're on Facebook. Are we on Facebook?
No.
But I'm on Facebook. My name is David Rutheiser. My website is creativedavid.com. That's creativedavid.com. And my I'm also on Facebook. And again, we're December 1st Writers. It's December1stwriters.com.
So, Sylvie, you were just finishing telling us about how when you write your poetry, it's one way of it's almost like a way of creating a memorial or a space of memory for your son.
Right, it is. I had saved 80 t-shirts that had, were AIDS related from a lot of different walks and a lot of different organizations. And I gave those to an organization that works with teenagers. But before I did that, I took pictures of them so that I can go back and remember those pieces of those t-shirts. I wore many of them for a long time. I wore those to work. I wore them, everywhere. Little things like that. And now that when I go through the boxes of I've kept a couple of boxes of my kids when they were children, and I'm going through these boxes and things are kind of deteriorating a little bit over the years. I just turned 80, so things are kind of old anyway. And it's a way to remember my children. It's a way to remember my son that died. One of the things that he said before he died, he says, the thing that makes me the saddest is that I will die and people won't remember that I even lived on this earth. And that's, because he was 31 and a half. And, when the older you get, the more that might be into you. But to young people living their lives and losing their lives at such a young age, that really stuck with me.
That's something that we've been going through again right now with this pandemic, and we could really do a
that's true
show just talking about remembering both of those. Before we go, I'm sorry that we only have an hour, because I would love to just continue this conversation for much longer than this. And and also, I miss all of you. I want to see you in person. I really miss all of you. I'm not sure if we got to Pat. I'm not sure if we got to a mention of how people can contact you or find your work. I'm pretty sure we've gotten Sylvie, Marla, and David. But Pat, could you tell us how people can reach you or find your work if they want to learn more about you?
Well, I'm on the December 1st Writers website. We each have our own page. And, you know, I have a few poems there and a prose piece posted on the website. And my email is there, and I welcome contact by email.
Okay, thank you.
And our website is December1stwriters.org. Is it .org? December1stwriters.com.
And Marla, I did want to especially get a chance to just ask you really briefly, how are you doing, like, with, I mean, both having to deal with surviving so long with HIV and now suddenly coming into this, you know, second pandemic? I mean, it's a first pandemic for most of us, but for folks who've had HIV, it's almost like a second pandemic.
It's like a second pandemic without the stigma, you know? Mm-hmm. There's the same thing going on, but there's no stigma.
Right.
So, this,
yeah. Well, thank you very much.
That's a big difference. Very big difference.
Thank you very much, all of you, for joining.
Thank you, Emma.
David, I'd like to give you the last word if you have anything else you'd like to share about the group or maybe what's coming up or just any final thoughts.
So, yeah, we are available. We give readings. We partner with organizations. We have read at the Oregon Capitol for the legislature. There are a number of things that we've done that we've been really happy to have the chance to be involved in. So please contact us, reach out to us if you're interested in finding out more about us or partnering with us, working with us, having us come to read with or share our work with you. Again, it's December1stwriters.com. And as Pat mentioned too, each of us on that, if you go to that website, and we have Marla to thank for designing that website.
Right.
She did a great job. And each of us has our own page on that website. So if you want to contact one of us individually, just click on our page and you have our contact information right there.
On the top, it says us. And if you just click on us, there's a drop-down menu and you can access each of our pages from the us link at the top.
Love that. Thank you so much, all of you, for joining us tonight on Transpositive. And have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Emma.
You
too. I'm Jamar Rogers, and I've been living with HIV for more than 6 years. You may know who I am from The Voice, but I'm also one of more than a million people living with HIV in the United States. I was kind of a reckless teenager. I got into some partying and things as a teenager and became addicted to crystal meth at the age of 18. I got really sick and was rushed to the emergency room and had no idea what was going on and didn't realize at the time that I had pneumonia and Kaposi's sarcoma. I only had 5 T cells, and it's a miracle that I'm even alive today. The first thing I would say to someone who just recently found out they were HIV positive is, one, you're not alone. You're not in this community by yourself, and you don't have to die from this. I'm a huge advocate for people living out their dreams and living out what inspires them. We were all put on this planet for a purpose, and just because you've gotten an HIV diagnosis doesn't mean that your life has to end here. If you know how to protect yourself, then you're not only protecting yourself, you're protecting any future partners you might have, you're protecting your children, but most importantly, you're protecting yourself. I would encourage my brothers and sisters to stay as educated and connected as possible. Once we can come together to eradicate stigma, well, then people can walk out with their heads high and they can feel okay about themselves. Just because someone has HIV doesn't mean that they don't have the same personalities, that their feelings don't get hurt. You know, I want to let people know that it's more common than you think. It is your cousin, your neighbor, your waiter. The thing that my mom did that helped me out so much was just let me know she would never leave my side, that she would always support me. That is the most effective help that anyone could ever receive, is just to know that you're going to be there and you're not going anywhere.
At first, my heart sunk. But because of his upbeat personality, and I believe he sort of kind of became okay with it just for that split second to tell me. His delivery wasn't doom or gloom, I'm gonna die. It's mom, I'm going to live. Can I come and live there with you? My son has HIV, but that doesn't define who he is.
Let's stop HIV together. Get the facts, get tested, get involved.
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Are you looking for a way to support your favorite community radio station this Giving Tuesday while also getting a chance to